we're back with Mr. Cy Abrams, and we're discussing his life in America. Mr. Abrams, why don't you tell me about moving out of the house that you were living in with your adopted parents, your aunt and your uncle? How did that happen? And
well, the reason we wanted to move out as fast as we can, as we felt that we were being mistreated, that if she did adopt us, she should have considered us as her family and to treat us the same as she does with her own children. And we felt bad enough trying to get used to a different environment, a different language, and being ridiculed at school and outside of school, that we wanted some warmth and some compassion shown, and it wasn't there. No one can replace a mother and father, but some people could at least try. And because I guess she did the best she could, but the reason she was a cold person, because even with her own children, she didn't show any affection. So it wasn't just us. But the discrimination about they can take up music lessons and we can't take music lessons. And they can take up acting in school plays and we can't. And they can have certain clothes and we can't. And they can go with their friends and we can't. So we felt that we have to get out as soon as we can and to do it on our own. The only way we could do it is to get any kind of work. We weren't fussy as to what kind of work we were going to do, just so it's an honest way to make a living. We were taught at an early age that there's only two ways to go. You either can go bad or you can be good. It's up to yourself. And we see plenty people hanging around the corners there in this town, and they don't do nothing. They just cause a lot of problems. And so we studied hard. We all studied hard in school and tried to abide by the rules and regulations in the school, and we respected everybody. And it was just time for us to move as soon as we can, as soon as we were able. So I figured out that on $12 a week, I can be on my own. So I paid $3 a month rent, $3 a week, I mean, $3 a week rent, and the rest was for food.
How close did you move? Far away or close?
Not too far. I'd say within radius of a couple of miles. Well, I had to move in a place where it'd be convenient for school as well as for work.
So, how old were you when you moved out?
I believe I was 15, I guess. Although they're supposed to keep us until we're 18, anyway. But I moved out at 15. And I found it wonderful to live by myself, knowing that I don't have to be abused. And I don't have to do chores. They gave me all kinds of chores to do there. She gave me 10 cents to see a double feature on Saturday, but before I get this 10 cents, I had to scrub all the floors, I had to clean all the dishes, I had to scrub the floor in the kitchen, and I had to do a lot of chores, about 4 or 5 hours work to get the 10 cents so I can go see a movie, you know. So I was so glad to be on my own, have my own room. And I really had no time for anything else beside going to school and work, you know. So I enjoyed doing that, and then eventually I moved to other places and went on from there. Moved to New York, you know, later
on.
When
you finished school.
Oh, yes. When I went to school, I wanted to go to high school. And she said, no, you can't go to high school. I said, why not? I said, I'm getting good grades. She said, because your uncle is a printer. See? And you make good money in printing. He says, and you have to make money because you'll have to support yourself. So I says, well, I really want to go to school. She said, no, you go printing. So I took up printing for 2 years. I got a diploma, and I went out on my first job. I was the second second best of the class in marks. So I went to New York and I got into a sweatshop, and there was a man about 70 years old, and he was an old-time printer. And he came out with a little box, wooden box, where they had separate little quarters for different letters, see? And then they give you a bunch of mixed up type, individual type, in a box. He said, now distribute this into the boxes where they belong, you know? So just getting out of school, you know, went like this, you know? He looks at it for a few minutes, he said, I'm sorry, you wouldn't do. And that was the end, see? I told him I'd just get out of school, you know. Anyway, so that discouraged me so much I never went to a print shop again. That was the end of my printing career. See? And I still wanted to go to school, but she can't do that. So after I got out of vocational school, it was half was high school, and half was training for printer. So I did get some academic work in there. So then from there I said, well, I'm not making enough money. I said, I have to get another job. So I changed jobs, and I got another job in a boys' clothing store, see? And there he gave me $15 a week. And then after I was there about a year, he promised to open a shop for me and I would manage this store, see? So I figured, well, I'm too young to manage a store, and I don't want the responsibility. I want to live a little. You know, I don't want to be tied down to a store. So I got another job that I figured would pay me more. If I work in a restaurant, I would get my meals there. And so I would be able to save more money. So I got a job in a restaurant, and they taught me how to make sandwiches and salads and ice cream sodas, you know, how to prepare the syrups and everything else. So here now I'm in my glory. I've got a job where the food is paid for. I don't have to worry about food. Don't have to worry about rent. Now I got much more left out of my paycheck, you know. So then I start admiring girls, see? So when I start admiring girls, I wanted to show off. So whatever money I had left from that week, I spent with a girl weekends. I take her to a theater, and then I take her to an ice cream soda place, you know? And by that time, I didn't have no money for the rest of the week, see? So I go back to my boss, and I ask him if he can loan me some money ahead of time, because I spent all my money on a date. So I learned my lessons, you know? I just enjoyed going out and having some fun. You know, I was 15, 16 years old. So after,
this was in New York?
This was in New Jersey. All this was in New Jersey.
Jersey.
I'm
okay.
Still in New Jersey. In New York, when I went to New York, I got a room there, see? And after I got a room, it was on 14th Street, I think, and I don't know if you know New York. No?
No, not.
This is 14th Street. Was all the activities there. They had the soap boxes and all kinds of people, different beliefs, you know. It was a very busy place. There was all the department stores there. And so I got one. It was over a cigar store, above the cigar stores, a rooming place. Very noisy all night long. You hear buses and streetcars, and you know. And I stayed there. I wanted a central location because I got a job in for a big company, a drug company. They had soda fountains all over New York. Something like 72 stores. So I worked for them because I had the experience already. I gathered experience in New Jersey, you know, working in restaurants and the soda fountains. So then I went to New York and I worked 6 stores a week. Every day I worked in a different store. I was relief man. So when people have a day off, I fill in for them. So I had very exciting places. One was in Times Square area, and the other one was in Pitkin and Herzl in Brooklyn. And then in Pennsylvania, Southern Brooklyn, and Brighton Beach Line on Brighton and 16th Street, the King's Highway. And I had different stores, Yorkville in New York. So I got good experience from different places, but I acclimate myself real fast to different kinds of jobs. And I lived in New York for quite a long time because I not only worked in one store, I worked in two different things. This job that I had was from 1 to 1, 12-hour shifts. So I worked six stores, 6 days like that. So I worked quite a few hours. I didn't have no time for anything, 12 hours a day, because it took me an hour to get there and an hour back on the subways.
So you just had enough time to sleep and
work. Yeah, that's about all. And then I decided I'm going to join the Golden Gloves, you know. So figure, well, where am I going to train? When will I have train? You know, so my sleeping time, I spent training, part of my sleeping time. This was taken there when I was in the Golden Gloves, see? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was experiencing different things, and then I got a lot of experience in New York being taken by many people in the streets, you know. Like one guy would come over and say, he's all dressed up real nice, he says, can you spare a quarter? I said, what for? He says, well, he says, I just got off from Connecticut, he says, and someone picked my wallet, and I'm waiting for an aunt. I have to call my aunt up so she'll pick me up, see? So I figured, geez, well, he's in trouble, so I give him the quarter. Then I come back an hour later, I see he's doing it to other people, see? So I learned a lesson, you know, to not to give money away so easily when I work so hard for it, you know. Another time there was somebody selling stockings, socks, you know, men's socks. Mm-hmm. So it was 6 pair for a quarter. I said, well, God, that's a good buy, you know. So I give him a quarter, I come home, I open up the socks. Each one was a different design. Each sock was a different design.
Oh, so you couldn't wear it. There were no
pairs. Well, they had like a clock, a little embroidery on the side, some of them, and some were without it. So I took them, all the socks, and I put them in a basin, and I put bleach in them and made them all white so I could use them for work, because they had to wear white socks at work, you know. So I bleached them all out to white. So I figured, well, I didn't get stuck too much, but, you know, you couldn't trust any of them. I go to an auction one. Went to an auction on Times Square, say, and they were selling the watches, you know. So I was working in this drugstore, you know, and I had a little intermission between the 1 to 1, you give you an hour break in the afternoon. So I was walking around there, see this auction. So when I get to the auction, they're auctioning off watches, you know. So I got a watch by the auction, you know. And I come back to the place there, and the thing doesn't work, stopped. You know, he was advertising 17 jewel watch and stuff like that, you know. And I said, geez, 17 jewel watch, I only paid $5 for it. I got a good buy on it. And I come there, he opened up the cover, it says 4 jewels, not 14 jewels, you know. So by all these little experiences, it taught me to be very careful, you know, about different things. But you learn through experience. So when you try to pass it to your grandchildren, you know, oh, they know all the answers. They don't want to listen to anything, you know.
How long did you live in New York?
Well, I lived in Greenwich Village for a while. My brother got a pad down there, and so we had wild parties there in Greenwich Village on McDougal Street. That was, you know, where the artists and all the people lived there. And when I stayed there, you know, it was one rainy evening, and I said, geez, I have nothing to do. It's my day off. I think I'm going to try to paint. So I went and I got some canvas and some brushes, and I painted two things. And that's one of, these are the two things right here. See?
Oh, is that all that you painted?
Napoleon, and then these two little kids wrestling.
Did you continue to do some painting, or was that all you did?
No, just, you know, because I didn't have no training or anything, you know. But I just got out of my system that I want to do something and try something. And so I did that, and it's been hanging over all my nephews and nieces' cribs. You know, that little picture of the kids wrestling. And I lived down there. Then I moved in with my brother and a pair. There was two other guys and him, four of us. So we lived right near New York University. So we had a lot of young girls from the college that used to come for weekends, you know, dancing and eating, you know, having fun. So this is the social life that I had, you know, very little of it. But I stayed in New York. I lived in Brooklyn, and I lived in New York City, Manhattan. I lived in the Bronx. I lived in different places according to where I worked to make it more convenient for myself.
What was the story about the Golden Gloves? How long were you doing that?
Oh, I went to Ebbets Field in New York. It's in Brooklyn. And I ran around the field there, you know, for training. And I did pretty good in the Golden Gloves. I had about, I'd say, 14 fights or something like that. But you get rings, you get watches, you get different things. You don't get no money at that time.
Did you win some of your fights?
Yeah, I won them all.
Terrific.
But I wouldn't continue. You know why?
That was enough? Or?
No, I didn't continue because a nice Jewish boy don't do this for a living. Huh. See? Everybody kept saying, nice Jewish boys don't do these things for a living. So you got to be a doctor, you got to be a lawyer, you got to be something. You got to have higher ideals than punched around with somebody else, you know?
Now, you were in the military?
Yeah, and then I went in the Coast Artillery when I was in New York, which is the 244th Coast Artillery in New York, and that was 1935. I was there for a year. And then after that, you know, in the Second World War, it was in there a couple of years, two, 3 years.
Now, how did you
I got the credit.
How did you meet your wife? Had you done this beforehand?
Oh, I went to, no, I went to, I went to Florida.
On a vacation?
No, I went to Florida to open, to get a concession on a soda fountain concession.
Okay.
And usually the drugstores have soda fountains. So you get a concession, you give them 20% of the gross. They collect the money, see? So they get 20% and you get the 80%. But at the 80%, you have to pay the utilities and you have to pay for the help and the merchandise. So he opened a place on 4th and Collins in Miami Beach.
Now, when was this?
This was in
1938. Okay.
And so I opened this place, and it was open from 7 in the morning to 1 at night. 18, how many hours? 7
That's
to 1.
Long hours.
Yeah, about 18 hours. But in the afternoon, I take 2-3 hours to go to the beach and just sun myself. So there was a lot of kids that used to come in from Georgia and Carolinas, you know, for the summer to work. So they worked as waitresses. They didn't get much money, but they were looking for to get away from home, I guess. And we were able to serve wine there, sandwiches, salads, short order cooking, lamb chops, pork chops, stuff like that. So I stayed there for the season. Then, after the season, I figured, well, I'd still like to work a little longer. So I went into the Blackstone Hotel in Miami Beach, and there was a soda fountain there and a short order area. So I started working there. That's where I met my wife. She was the cashier. And I used to throw a nickel to her. She had one of those machines, you know, where you put a nickel in. As time goes by, Casablanca with what's the name? That movie star.
I'm not sure which one.
As time goes by is the name of the song.
Right, I'm familiar with the song.
Yeah, well, the one was in it. Ingrid Bergman and I can't think of the.
Well, that's okay.
Anyway, I kept throwing nickels to her because she liked that song and I liked that song. And then one day we went out after work at the beach, you know, it was that big, big moon, you know. And we got along pretty good. And I told her, I said, she was going home to Cleveland and I was going home to New York. I said, I'll tell you what, I said, if you feel the same way about me and I feel the same way about you in 6 months, I says, write to me and I'll send you fare to come from Cleveland to New York and we'll get married. So sure enough, we only knew each other 2 days. And it seemed to click somehow. Because she was orphaned real early and I was orphaned, and you know, and it seemed to work out because we needed somebody. So there was waited 6 months, and sure enough, I get a call. I'd like to come to New York. So I sent her the fare, and she came to New York. And things were pretty bad at that time. I was working on 2 jobs, one from 11 to 3, and then another one from 4 to 1.
So you didn't get to see very much of each other.
Didn't see much of her, and I lived in a room, and we had a salami hanging there, and a rye bread, and that's all we were eating. It was pretty rough. And so she got a job, you know, she started working. And we got along fine after that.
Did you have children?
No, but she had about four times that she aborted. See? And then that's when I decided to adopt a child later on.
And you adopted a child?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Then, well, that was after. This was in New York, see, but when I moved out of New York and went to Cleveland.
So you both moved to Cleveland.
We decided to go to Cleveland because her family lived in Cleveland and they wanted us to come out there and live there. And they were much better off than we were. So they were gonna set us up in something. So we went to her sister and we lived with her sister in Cleveland. And then I got a job in a machine shop there as a milling machinist. Because during the war, at first I was working as a machinist. I took up training for machinist work. So we went got to Cleveland and we set up home. And we were already married a couple of years. Then the Second World War started. So we already opened up an apartment and furnished it and everything else. So we had to store everything away. And she had to go back to live with her sister again. And I volunteered for services. They agreed that if I volunteered, they would give me a certain rating, see? Mm-hmm. Because I was already a machinist and they promised to give me a portable machine shop and I would be directing 5 other men under me. So they gave me a rating before I went into the Army. I mean, after basic training.
So then when did you adopt your child? Was that after you came back from the war?
When I came up after the war, well, while I was in the war, she became pregnant when I was on leave. But she lost it. So then when I came back, I talked to her about adopting. We had one child when I came back. Not one child. When I came back, she became pregnant, and she aborted herself. And I want to know why she aborted. She said, "Well, I don't want my child to be born poor, and poor, you know, that we don't have no money. And I was brought up in a poor family, and I know how much suffering we had to do, and we don't want to bring a child up that way." And I said, "It doesn't matter." I said, "One child that wouldn't need to take that much, you know. If you love each other, there's no reason why we can't have the child now." But she brought her up without my consent. When she aborted, things changed after that. I didn't feel as close to her because she did something like that, you know. It's different if we weren't married at that time, but we were married already. So after she aborted it, then many years later, I asked her, I said, "How about adopting a child?" So she said, "Well, we'll try for more." So we tried for 7 years now. I says, what's the sense of trying anymore? I said, after you have the child, you can't carry it no more. You know, after 6 months, 7 months, and she'd lose it all the time. So I said, let's put in for adoption. So we put in for adoption, and we got a child. And then we had a lot of trouble with the adoption.
You had trouble with the adoption?
Yeah. the girl wanted the child back after we had it 6 months. And we became so attached to the child that I was not going to give that child up. And I didn't. I said, if I have to go to Mexico and live the rest of my life in Mexico, I will. But I will not give that child up. It's not because the mother wanted it for her own. She wanted to give it to someone else because there was more money involved. And I said, here we got the baby 6 months. We're used to the child. We love that child. We will not part with it. So I went to New York with the child, and my wife stayed here. And I contacted some people in Cleveland. One was a Superior Court judge, and her brother-in-law, my wife's brother-in-law, was an attorney out there. And they said, it's a cut and dry deal in California. If the mother wants the child back, she gets it back. She said, nothing you can do about it. I said, well, I'm not giving that child up.
Now, this was in Cleveland?
In Cleveland. I went there for consultations with
the
Superior Court judge, and he came out here on my behalf to see what he could do for me. And he couldn't do nothing either, the Superior Court judge. So I had a friend, and he says to me, and he knew the trouble I had, and he says to me, let me take a stab at it. Let me talk to the girl. And he went, and he bought her some clothes, and he took her out and showed her nice times, you know, and tried to reason with her until he reasoned with her the fact that she'd be better off where she is. She's well-loved, and these people you don't know, just because they're going to give you $500 more, or so. So what he did is talk her into signing the papers. And she didn't bother us after that. She was only 15 years old, the girl, see, that had my daughter.
Name?
Judy.
Judy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have any grandchildren?
I have two grandchildren.
What are their names?
Their name is Damien and Nadia. And they're half Chinese and half Jewish.
Okay, Mr. Abrams, later on you put this book together called Glancing Back. Now, mm-hmm. How did you go about putting that book together?
Well, it's powerful memories.
Well, we've heard very powerful memories on
this tape. Powerful memories based on my early life. It's not a continuous story or anything. It's just incidents in my life that were powerful enough for me to remember. And going through this writing class brought out more things that I thought I didn't remember, because there were similar cases that other people had, similar events that made me think back and to things in my life which were similar. So it really reacted a lot of things that I forgot all about. So in creative writing, you help each other. You critique the stories. You don't tell them they're wrong about this or wrong about that. You're just critiquing and tell them how they can possibly make it better to make it more interesting for other people to read it. So you have to put yourself in a position as a child and write in a child's language as you would talk when you're a child. So this is how we got our story together. We had three classes. There were three classes for senior citizens, and they're by a high school teacher that started these classes because he himself, his father was a psychiatrist, and he never knew nothing about his father. When his father died, he had nothing to remember him by because he didn't relate to him in any way. There was no communication. So he decided that the older people, the senior citizens, should have something to leave to their grandchildren or people that they love or relatives that they know. So I was very happy to take this because it was like a therapy to me. after I wrote this thing, I felt 100% better. All this time it was in me.
And now it was
Now, and it's a relief. It makes you feel better. It's therapy in every sense of the word.
Well, I want to thank you for doing this interview with us. These are fascinating stories that I'm sure will be used again and again as part of our project. This is Elisa Mattson signing off for the Oral History Project at Ellis Island. It's September 17, 1994, with Mr. Cy Abrams and Peter Hom, who's been doing the recording for us today. Thank you.
You're welcome.